Medieval Europe was a litigious society, and people of all backgrounds engaged in the legal courts for various reasons. Women were present as plaintiffs, defendants, and witnesses in both secular and religious courts. The records that these courts produced have served as invaluable sources for medieval historians, providing us with a window into many different aspects of people's lives. Court records not only tell us about people's licit and illicit activities, they also give us insight into how society functioned and practiced. In today's podcast episode, I speak with Dr. Shannon McSheffrey about a set of court records from the Consistory Court in late medieval London, and how we can use such records to explore the experiences of women who appear before it. Dr. McSheffrey is a historian of late medieval and early Tudor England, and her research interests explore gender roles, law, civic culture, marriage, literacy, heresy, and popular religion in late medieval England. Among her many publications are Marriage, Sex, and Civic Culture in Late Medieval London, and Seeking Sanctuary, Crime, Mercy, and Politics in English Courts from 1400 to 1550. She has also developed several digital history projects, including a website, which we're going to discuss today, which includes translations of the Consistory Court records in late medieval London. Thank you so much, Shannon, for taking the time today to share your knowledge on the Consistory Court and this wonderful website that you've created for use for all historians. The fact that it's open access is really exciting.
Thanks.
So I'm going to start with a question about that website. So your website, sharing this material from the Consistory Court in late medieval London, is really an amazing resource, as I mentioned, for medieval historians, but also in the context of this course, specifically for those interested in gender and women's history. Let's start us off with thinking about what this actually is. What was the Consistory Court? How did it operate? And what was its jurisdiction? And then a follow-up, how did someone actually engage with this court? How did they bring a suit in it?
A little bit of larger background. The medieval Catholic Church was divided into regions. Each one is a diocese. Yeah. And England had 17 of them, and the Diocese of London was one of them. So this involved the city of London itself, but also it's the area north of London, a chunk of territory actually north of the city itself. So each of the dioceses had a court system, and then the Consistory Court was the highest court. And the church courts in general had the jurisdiction over issues that related to the sacraments of the church, which included, for instance, marriage, which is central, in fact, to the Consistory Court. Also, anything dealing with the swearing of oaths, because that was a religious act, and so it could come into a church court, or sin, especially sexual sin, most particularly. Other things like homicide were also a sin, but the king's courts claim jurisdiction over homicide. So you didn't see that. But sexual sin, on the other hand, was something that the church courts dealt with quite a lot. Some church courts were effectively like criminal courts where people were prosecuted and brought into the court to answer to an allegation, for instance, of sexual misdeeds. But the Consistory Court was mostly a court that dealt with litigation. In other words, people suing one another over one of those issues that the church had jurisdiction over, especially, as I said, in the 15th century, most of the cases in the court involved marriage in some way. So this was really the primary venue in which people worked out legal issues that related to marriage. That, of course, is one of the reasons why it's so interesting to us as gender historians, is because marriage in that period involved a man and a woman. They did not have same-sex marriage. And so therefore, the cases all in some way did involve women, which was not the case in most law courts of medieval England. Most law courts of medieval England were heavily male dominated. So this gives us an opportunity to see more about women's lives and the place of marriage in it, which was fairly central. Doesn't mean that everybody involved in these cases actually got married. So we do get a bit of a sense of the women who either chose to or were unable to marry as well. To launch a case in the court, you would usually, depending on who you were, but most people would end up having to take advice from basically local people who knew, men who were experienced in the ways of the law, who lived in your neighborhood, your parish priest, something like that. And then they would, in a sense, connect you with one of the church lawyers who could help you bring a case. You needed to have lawyers to help you formulate the case. It was a relatively expensive proposition, which probably means that if you were very poor or even in the bottom third of the population or so, you probably would not be able to afford to bring a case. But these were important issues to people, and they were willing to spend money in order to deal with them in a court. So they were willing to pay.
And so that's interesting. The person who brings the suit is the one that has to pay the court costs, or are they shared between the people that are involved?
It depends on, and that's something that we don't know for London because of the fact that we don't have the records for that. But we know from other consistory courts in England in this time that it would depend, just as it often does today, on whether you win your case. That often the loser has to pay court costs, and that ends up becoming part of the settlement. So there's a bit of, just as today, a little bit of a gamble that you're making. Mm-hmm. And it does mean that if you are the plaintiff, if you are the person who's bringing the suit, known as the plaintiff, then you shouldn't do it frivolously because it's going to cost you even more money.
Okay. The civil court records that I've worked on for Valencia, the way that court was set up was the loser paid the court costs. So I was just curious about that. So let's add a little bit to our discussion of context and think about the city of London in the late medieval period where this court was located. We've had a class looking at women's lives in medieval Paris and spoke to Emily Hutchison about her work on that city. So what was urban life like in London?
It was probably pretty similar in many ways. London was fairly significantly smaller than Paris in this period. Paris was the largest city north of the Pyrenees and the Alps. And it may even have been, I think, the largest city in general.
And that's what Emily said. Yeah, it was a little larger than Florence.
So London was a fair bit smaller, although it was still the largest city in England in this period. It's in the second tier of Europe in this period, meaning on the world stage that it was significantly farther down the ladder. It was a relatively underpopulated place, relatively undeveloped in some senses. So London was smaller than Paris, but they shared, England and Northern France especially, shared common economy and social culture as women. And especially when you're talking about things like how the urban economy worked, women's place in it, and marriage customs are relatively similar to one another. My documents in the consistory database, I feel as if I own them, are in a narrow chronological range. They're from the 1480s and 1490s. And that is a period where London, and in fact, this would be the case in Paris as well, is undergoing a significant economic contraction. And one of the effects of that economic contraction is that women's economic opportunities are less elaborated than they had been earlier. And I'm not sure what Emily said about the space, but there is, at least to a light extent, somewhat more of a constriction of women's lives in a more general way. Most of the women who we can see working in these documents, their people are giving witness testimony about what people are doing in various situations. Many of the women, at least, are explicitly working as they're going about their day, but most of them are working in domestic service, or they are the mistress of a household or something. Yeah. But the women who are employed are, in the vast majority, employed as servants. So they don't have a big range of possible work that they can undertake, or certainly what you might call career defining work and things like that. It tends to be, as Olwen Houghton once very famously said, an economy of makeshift is the labor world of women. And that was the case for London in this period too.
So they pick up what work is available to them and that they can fit it into their days in different ways.
And it's also just, it's considered to be the sort of a life stage before marriage, that in a period between entering into adolescence and marriage, which is often about a 10-year period between 14 and 22, 24 or so, which is when women were normally getting married, that in that period, they would work as domestic servants. That was the expected and indeed the kind of respectable thing to do in that intervening period.
That was one of the things that my own work that I really
I've thought a lot about was these young women that moved to the city or are in the city already. In Valencia, they're 8 to 12 and they start working as domestic servants, and then they work till they're 18, 19, 20 and then get married.
Yeah, I think that the age ranges are a bit shifted the north as compared. Yeah. And so they're coming a bit later than that in terms of age range, but they're also getting married a bit later too.
I had a great discussion with Michelle and Susan about how we think about these frameworks in terms of marriage for Northern and Southern Europe and how they're slightly different, but also how they're similar in some ways. I should also note that the very first reading that my students did was Judith Bennett's chapter on the patriarchal equilibrium. So they did learn some things about women in the brewing industry and in England, which was great. So we've talked already a little bit about the type of cases that are brought before this court. And what my students are going to be reading some examples that you've shared with us. But can you talk about some of these cases and what this was like? So just to give us an idea of the range of things that happened in it.
Okay. Most of the cases, the bedrock issue at law, because we'll talk a little bit more about methodology in a moment. Yeah. These are not just randomly generated stories. Yes. These are specific to legal issues. So the usual legal issue is, did a man and a woman make a binding contract of marriage with one another, which was an exchange of words. I, Shannon, take thee, Eric, as my lawfully wedded husband. I, Eric, take thee, Shannon, as my lawfully wedded wife. And then when you say those words, those are performative legal words that create in them a binding contract, as it was called. And so that's usually the specific legal issue that's at stake. That's not the only thing that could be the basis of litigation, but most of them are that the usually, not always, but that the plaintiff is suing the defendant because the plaintiff claims that they are married to the defendant. Unlike modern marital litigation, which is overwhelmingly about divorce, the overwhelming majority of medieval marital litigation in England, at least, was about enforcing a marriage rather than dissolving a marriage. And the kinds of cases then are people then, the evidence that we have is in fact the witness's testimony. So we don't have the plaintiff's claim. They had to write out, this is what I'm claiming. What we have is the interrogation or examination, is a better word, of the witnesses in response to the plaintiff's claim.
Okay.
So they're usually then telling the court the story of how they were a witness to the speaking of those words.
Okay.
So you get all kinds of detail about how did people orchestrate such an event. One of the surprising things, I guess, is that you can make a binding contract of marriage, and apparently most people did make the binding contract of marriage outside of a church. Mm-hmm. There's no priest present. It is a religious act. It is treated as a sacred exchange of vows, but there didn't need to be a priest present for it to be a valid contract of marriage. And most of the time, at least according to the evidence that we see in these cases, people have a gathering of people and then they orchestrate this exchange in front of the witnesses. Sometimes there is much more informal. They're in the middle of a field and they exchange these vows of marriage with two other farm workers. Sometimes they're in a tavern having a social gathering and they end up exchanging these vows in front of the people in the tavern. Mm-hmm. And so you get a sense of how this integrates into their everyday life, how it is that you get sense of what the architecture of the houses in which people are living. One of the things that I noticed is that in the cases where the people are servants, that they're much more likely to be doing this in a tavern. Because the domestic space of the house, when you're a servant, you're living with your employer. And so you don't have control over the social space of the house. That's for the family. And so you have your social space actually in the tavern. You're much more likely to be making these kinds of exchanges, which are vitally important to your life, in this space of a drinking house. So it does give you, when people say what they were doing. So you get all sorts of evidence about everyday life. Sometimes they have to testify in order to validate what it is that they've just said, to give circumstantial details. detail, they'll ask them, okay, what were the people wearing? And so sometimes interesting, usually it's not super elaborated, but it's kind of interesting just to see how do they describe the clothes and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of stuff in there.
One of the things that I was fascinated by when I was looking at my civil court cases of dowry restitution was those little details. So one of the things I found, because it's very formulaic in some ways, right? There are these stages that they go through. But every once in a while, you learn these little things that a few of my cases, they testified about what they ate at the wedding feast. And apparently there was this thing called the wedding bread that was very common. It's a Valencian tradition, apparently. So they talked about this wedding bread that they ate, and everyone knew what that meant. So that meant I had to try and figure this out. What is a wedding bread?
That's really interesting. There doesn't seem to be a specific food that stands, like that in a sense is symbolic of the wedding, which that's really interesting. And instead you have some other things, like perhaps not surprisingly, people exchange rings is a not uncommon thing, but they also exchange particular kinds of coins.
Oh, wow.
That there's, they're not handing over, you know, something like a dowry or marriage portion. Yeah. But it's that the coin is itself a kind of symbol of the economic union of the couple that is going to be taking place as a result of the marriage. And other things like a lot of little religious tokens, such as something called an Agnus Dei, in other words, a Lamb of God, which seems to have been a little probably wooden, but could be pewter image of a lamb, which is symbolizes Jesus. So all sorts of interesting little insights into just the materiality of life and what it is that objects meant to them and stuff like that.
That's fascinating. Those little details help us understand medieval life in a much richer way. At least it helps us imagine it, what people's lives were actually like, which can often be really hard for us to get at because of the nature of the sources that have survived. So that's why I like working with court records, I think, because they give us those. So we've already started talking about methodology, but let's spend some more time on this question. So how do historians use these types of sources like these consistory records in their work? And in particular, I wanted to think about using them as a gender historian, because one of the things that I've been emphasizing to my students is that as gender historians, we approach our historical sources in different ways. And some things we do the same, but some things are different. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that this will all relate, but one of the things about using legal sources as using things like your notarial records in Girona, that you always have to remember in the case of witness testimony, where somebody is telling you a story, it is easy to lose track of the legal context that produced the document in the first place. And so what I mean by that is that we always have to remember that this person is in court to give testimony in a partisan way. They are always appearing in these cases because they're coming forward almost always voluntarily in order to support the case that their friend is bringing to the court. Usually it's a friend, sometimes it's a relative, but you're doing it in order to support your friend, let's just say. And so one of the things to remember is that person is going to try to give you as the reader, i.e. the judge, the most persuasive version of the story that they can. And so they are, for instance, often going to emphasize, and here's where we start to get the gender issues coming in, for instance, if they want to claim that a woman has, in fact, made a contract of marriage with their friend John, so the woman is Alice, the man is named John, and they want to emphasize that Alice was a willing participant in this exchange of marriage vows, then they're going to emphasize how obedient she was, how she behaved in a way that made it seem as if she wanted to do nothing more than to put herself under the governance of this man. There's a lot of emphasis on depicting proper gendered behavior. And the opposite can also happen in very interesting ways, where if a woman is actually trying to get out of a marriage that she doesn't want. Either you have a number of cases which are quite interesting, where a woman is being pressured to marry a man, and he and his friends are all surrounding her and trying to pressure her to say yes. And a lot of the time, I'm not going to say that it never happens where a woman behaves in a very forthright manner, because most of the time she's going to try to put them off in a kind of polite way. And so she's going to say, oh, I can't make a commitment because I need to go and ask my father. I can't possibly make a commitment like that without talking to my dad about it. So she's then presumably hoping she's going to go to dad and say, Dad, I really don't want to marry that guy. He's hoping that dad is going to then turn around and go, I refuse to give my consent. But there's a number of cases where dad actually ends up being a witness for the guy.
Dad actually
does want her to marry. And so she has tried, in a sense, to get out of it by displacing the rejection onto her father, either because socially it is too awkward for her to outright reject this suitor. She has been socialized not to be so decisive that way. And so she's going to try to put it onto her father. Yeah. And probably a lot of times that worked, but in some cases, clearly it didn't
work.
Because there's a number of cases where the parents of the woman are testifying against her in the case.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So mom and dad really are using the court to help push their family strategies on the marriage, leaving the woman, in other words, bereft of any kind of support. And I think in most cases, those women end up marrying this guy because they don't have an easy way to
get out of it.
In other words, one of the things that you need to think about as you're reading these is that you need to be alert always and to continue to keep in your mind that this isn't just a straightforward window into a past happening. This is always one person's version of what happened. And that you always, so if you're going to picture something, try, I know this is hard. Sometimes I love these stories and I do picture in my mind the narrative that the witness is giving you, but you should have maybe a little picture of the witness telling the story as you're doing it, just to continue to remind you that is the witness's version of things, not what actually happened.
That's an important reminder for thinking about legal records, right? Because we've spent some time talking about the differences between theory and practice, but even in documents of practice, we have to remember, especially when we're working with legal materials, these are constructed for a reason and people are trying to present a particular picture so that they win.
Exactly. And that's it. You always have to keep in mind that it is not just a story being told for students in a course at UNBC in 2022. These are allegations or partisan statements that are being produced in a lawsuit in 1489. And that also, one of the things is that a lawyer is helping them make sure that they're going to talk about the legally important points. And so they always have to have the exact form of the words when it's a question of whether or not there has been a valid legal marriage that has taken place by the exchange of the proper words. You always have to have that form of the words in the testimony, or it's not going to be worth anything. There was one case I remember where the putative husband, the man claimed to be a husband, a witness, I think, is telling this story, where the husband is in negotiation actually with the woman's father, and they have this whole long back and forth about whether or not he's asking for permission to marry the daughter and things like that, which is legally not relevant. Whether the father agrees to the marriage is actually not part of the lawsuit. And they've forgotten to put anything about the woman consenting to the marriage, right? And then somebody goes back and adds it into the margin.
Oh, interesting.
And so somebody must have noticed and then said, oh, we've got to ask the witness, what did the woman say? Because it's irrelevant whether the father consented. And so in the margin, it says, and then the woman said, I take thee, John, to be my lawful wedded husband. And she thereby consented to the union. Yeah. The legally important thing is that the woman has to consent. But in some of the cases, clearly there's family dynamics going on that in the minds of the witnesses in some ways are farther up their ranking of what's important in the case. But it ends up being shaped by a lawyer who's going to make sure that they're going to emphasize the importance of the two individuals consenting.
When we think about what makes marriage valid in the medieval period, I think that's one question that my students are always surprised at, that in fact, a legally valid marriage only involves the consent of the couple. The parents actually have no role at all. And while there's tension between different types of law about that, in practice, it's the couple that matters. And my students are always super surprised. And I said, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing this freely. Like, we don't know. Is their family standing behind them and staring at them? Okay, come on, say those words. We don't know what's going on. In practice, it's only the couple that's involved. And I think it's very different from what they expect.
Yeah, no, exactly. And when historians first realized that, which was actually really in the 1970s, that they really began to understand that importance of the individual consent of the two parties. If you look at the scholarship from that period, they call this astonishing, and they were very surprised about it too. And although one of the things that the cases in this court show is that family dynamics are still important for some people. In a general way, the wealthier people were, the more it mattered because there was more economically at stake in the union. And so families usually were controlling the purse strings. The most extreme example is aristocratic marriages, where for the most part, they're simply arranged by the families, and especially the women involved at most have a right of veto, but even that they don't always seem to have. But if you are a relatively poor woman who often has been living away from your parents since you were 14, you are now in your early to mid 20s, you live quite a long ways away from your parents. And often your parents are deceased because people did die young on a frequent basis due to things like pandemics. And so the poorer women, somewhat ironically, have actually a lot more freedom of choice when it comes to marriage. And they don't have obviously complete freedom of choice because they're not going to be able to marry a wealthy man very in their sort of social group. Their marriages are much more likely to be framed within a personal choice that is about things like sexual attraction. You can see that sort of dynamic is at work in some of the cases where clearly there is this kind of, as I think I wrote about it at one point, you know, thinking about what exactly might we call romantic love today, that mixture of personal affection with a sexual dynamic going on as well. And that's clearly the case in some of the cases. And in some of the cases, you get a conflict where the family wants one guy and she wants another guy. And one can only guess that the other guy that she wants is somebody that she has fallen in love with. I always have this imagination where he's dashing and handsome and the family choice is somebody who's not nearly as dashing.
Exciting. Yes, handsome.
Is probably, in some cases, is probably older, whereas the one that she chooses is close to her in age and stuff like that.
I think court records are so wonderful because they give us a window into all these dynamics that can be really hard to get at in thinking about how families worked, but also how marital relationships were created and functioned, and within social circles as well as within family circles. And I always think that in the places where we have those court records that survive, we're so fortunate because they give us a different understanding of how these societies function that we can't get at in other types of sources. So I think we've talked a little bit about this already, but what can we learn about women's experiences from these records? And I think we've covered this a little bit, but let's focus on the law. So as a legal scholar, can you talk about the role of such court records in helping us understand women's lives? I think we've talked about the information that we can draw out of them, but are there other things that we should be thinking about?
Let's see. One of the things I think that we do need to pay attention to is thinking about the court itself as a gendered space and how it is that it's complicated, but that we need to think about women's access to legal expertise and how that affected how they could bring cases. So one of the things that's interesting about these specific set of cases is that it was actually statistically somewhat more likely for men to sue a woman to enforce a marriage than for a woman to sue a man to enforce
it. Oh, interesting.
It's not completely unbalanced one way or the other, but an assumption that a lot of historians made in the past, and sometimes again, they're mystified by the idea, because surely in the past, men didn't want to get married. There's one particular historian of marriage I'm thinking of who is just like, well, obviously women want to get married, men don't want to get married. So the whole dynamic is that men are running away and women are chasing. Mm-hmm. And at least in the end of the 15th century, interestingly, that's not really the case. There are times where clearly a woman has been disadvantaged in some way by not marrying the specific man or being left in an ambiguous situation. Sometimes clearly the man is wealthier than the woman, or the woman, some, not all of the women are 20 something, never married servants. Quite a few of the people who are involved are on their second or third marriage. So sometimes they're in their 50s. There are widows in their 30s with a bunch of children, and in an economic and in a social sense, they need to have a husband. Mm-hmm. But the important thing to understand is that men need wives.
Yes.
And that one of the reasons why it is that men are often the plaintiffs in these cases is that the way that the economy, especially, well, it works also in the countryside, but actually even more so in London itself. The household economy of late medieval London required there to be basically a wife to run the household so that the husband could run the business. And that meant that for a man to function economically, he really needed to have a wife. And so the notion that only women want marriage and that men get hoaxed into doing it, which is an underlying kind of assumption that sometimes historians have and maybe lurks in a lot of the backs of our brains. And there's an underlying assumption that women economically benefit from marriage more than men do. That doesn't really work for late medieval London because of the fact that a craftsman cannot run his business unless he has a wife that runs the household in which the craft workshop is located. There are interesting kind of social reasons why it is that if you're an unmarried man, you can't hire a housekeeper. There really is no such thing as a housekeeper. And in this period, it seems to be because it's considered to be an impossibility for a housekeeper to live with an unmarried man without there being an implication of sexual misbehavior.
Yeah.
And so basically it's got to be a wife because then there's an assumption that they're having sex and that's okay. It's interesting again, how sex works into all of this as well. And so one of the things then that we see is all sorts of different circumstances where both partners are needing to have a spouse, but that sometimes, for instance, women don't need spouses. So you will see widows who have enough money to support themselves. Interestingly, if you are a widow and you have enough property to support yourself, you don't need a husband. Whereas if you are a widower, if you are a man who has lost his wife, you need to find a new wife. And men remarried far more quickly than women did. And there are times where it's literally within a few weeks of the wife dying. If you've got children, you need to have a wife because you've got to have somebody looking after the kids. And the custom apparently, and it's unclear how strictly people observed it, but you see every once in a while in the testimony, you can see somebody making a comment about that they needed to wait for a year before, after their husband died. But for the man, you can sometimes see them like literally it's a few weeks. It's astounding, actually. And the explanation to me is that that it is a more urgent situation for the men. Yeah. And so it becomes allowed that they do that. Whereas for the women, it's not actually necessarily an urgent situation. And so they wait. And sometimes there's a few cases where widows are clearly, I've looked around at the options and I've just decided I'm going to stay single. I'm not that interested. And so they stay single.
That's really interesting. Alex and I actually have a case in Girona where a conversa, a converted Jewish woman, her husband dies and she remarries within 2 months of his death. And she gets special permission from the king to do so because her first husband's family is trying to remove her as the guardian of her her son, who's a year old, and also try to prevent her marrying this other man. And she's obviously very wealthy and she goes to the king. Her family has a longstanding relationship with the king and she goes to the king and says, look, I need to do this. And so the king says, okay. And so she remarries within about 2 months after her first husband has died. And this is very scandalous. The family of the first husband is all up in arms about this and they're very unhappy about it. So,
There is a case where a woman, or at least one case, but I was just working with it the other day, where a widow allegedly makes a contract with a man, but says, we're just going to keep this secret because otherwise it's going to be too scandalous because it's too soon after my husband's death.
So she's aware. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's one of the things that I started with in the course and then that we've emphasizing in these distinctions between theory and practice, which I think is really important for history more generally, but also for thinking about women and noting the differences between prescriptive and descriptive sources and understanding women's lives. So I wonder if you might explore the relationship between the theory of canon law and its practice in consistory records. And this week, we're actually going to be talking more about law and a follow-up about this. And I think, again, we've already talked about this, but how women used law and used legal structures that were available to them.
Okay, so the theory and the practice, one of the things that there's a fairly interesting dichotomy between what the lawyers and the theologians who were talking about, say, the sacrament of marriage and how to make it and how it should be judged and things like that, what they emphasized, which is often a kind of European-wide body of thought. And that would be applied differently in different places. So some historians have looked at how certain ideas were applied, say, in northern France. One of the things that canon law allows for, we've been talking mostly about the enforcement of contracts, but it also allows for the dissolution of marriage, or what we would call today a judicial separation, where the couple is allowed to live apart from one another. And one of the grounds of a judicial separation is adultery of one of the spouses. So if it can be proved in a court that one of the spouses committed adultery, then you are allowed to have a decree that allows you to live apart, because otherwise, actually, when you are married, you must cohabit. And not only must you cohabit, but you must have sexual relations with each other when one or the other partner wants. So that's one of the origins of an idea that comes into common law, which is that it is impossible for a husband to rape a wife, something that was in Canadian law until the 1990s, I think, actually. So you can get a judicial separation for adultery. And in northern France, where it's actually fairly common for such judicial separations to be awarded on the basis of adultery. You have quite a few cases on that. In England, it is quite rare.
Interesting.
And even though clearly, like, lots of people are being prosecuted for adultery, but not very many people are actually then using that, because it would have to come from the husband or the wife.
Yeah.
To come forward and say, now I want to have a judicial separation on the basis of their adultery. And so it's actually quite rare. And I'm not sure which of the cases that you've assigned, but there is in fact one of the cases that I suggested, which was one, possibly it was actually a very mixed up case where it could be because the wife has been cruel, because cruelty is another grounds, or because she committed adultery because she was alleged to have done both. And that's a really interesting case, but it's also extremely unusual in the whole kind of corpus of these things. And so It was, so the separation on the basis of adultery in England was, it just doesn't seem to be something that mm-hmm. people did. There's also a lot of emphasis in the canon law of marriage that a lot of historians spent a lot of time talking about in the first three quarters of the 20th century. And that is the issue of consanguinity, the idea that if you were too closely related, that you cannot be married. And that there was a lot of time and energy spent by canon lawyers and theologians thinking about exactly how close is too close and that kind of thing. And they wrote a lot of treatises about it. And in late medieval England, there are zero cases, I believe.
Wow. So they weren't worried about that at all.
And so that nobody on the ground seemed to have cared. And it's not used as a basis, or at least very rarely used as a basis. It's clearly, although the lawyers were writing about it a lot then, but actual courts, and I'm not even talking about the people, but actually the courts themselves don't seem to have pursued situations. Where it was an issue. So it's one of those disconnects between what it is that the legal treatise writers are focused on and what it is that's actually happening in the law courts can sometimes be quite distinct from one another.
That's why I think it's so important. It's so useful when we can access both, right, within a particular region, because it really gives us, I think, a better sense of how the law was a breathing instrument rather than just simply something written by men who want these things to happen. We don't actually know if they're, but that's really interesting about adultery. I have a few cases in the civil court records in Valencia where the husband brings a suit against his wife to get her dowry, actually, to take her dowry from her because she's committed adultery. And adultery is a reason for why she would lose her dowry. And the husband always wins in those particular cases.
That's interesting. I cannot think of any cases like that would presumably be in England would be in a secular court, but I just, I cannot think of any cases that are like that. Where I mean, it just doesn't seem to be. It's partly that I think in Southern Europe, the notarial culture seems to have made that whole question of marital property a much more regulated thing.
It's highly regulated, actually. And I think people are very aware of how they can use the law in different ways in order to enforce that regulation. From my cases, it's really clear these women know what they're doing. They know how to go to court. They know what they have to say. They know the things that need to be a part. And they have, sometimes they have legal representatives that present petitions for them, and sometimes they don't. But clearly there's people that are telling them how to do this successfully. Because in the 200 and so odd cases I looked at, they won in all of them but three. And those three cases, the judge actually asked for further examination. They essentially always won. That's a pretty high success rate. So let me ask you, say a student would like to do a project thinking about women's involvement in litigation during the medieval period as their project, and maybe they want to use these records as their sources. What advice would you give to them, and how should they start?
I think that the one thing that they could do is to look, when I go into a new project, one of the things that I do, and honestly, this is part of what it is that makes an archival type historian, like both of us, is that we just love to get into new kinds of sources to see what sorts of interesting, fascinating things are in them. Not everybody is quite as fascinated as we are. But I think that, first of all, just reading around a little bit and things, but using the keywords, tags, just to see, is there something that's intriguing about particular topics, and looking at some of the cases that come up to see if there's something that you want to explore. And so if the particular angle is women's involvement in litigation, then maybe think about, do you want to look at cases where women were plaintiffs? Go through the cases and see when you see the first name is the plaintiff. And so you see the women first, or women as defendants, the opposite. And another thing to think about is looking at any evidence that you have about how it is that a woman puts a case together. There's little hints, but amongst the most important things is, who do you bring as your witnesses? Each of the parties, who is it that's acting for them in the court? And one of the somewhat depressing, if I can put it this way, aspects of this is that you note that both parties are far more likely to ask men to be witnesses. And the reason for that is that men are more trustworthy. They are considered to be, trustworthy is the big word that was used in the courts at the time, but that they are people that you can give faith to, that they have stature. And so when you were looking around for your witnesses, you're going to choose, if you have enough men, you will choose men over women, and you will choose the oldest men that you can find, and you will choose the men of the highest status that you can find. But you're stymied because you also, for instance, if you are looking for people who can testify that they were present when you made your vows of marriage, it has to be somebody, at least in theory, it should be somebody who was actually there. Now, I say that because I think it's quite likely a lot of times that people are faking their evidence, but that is how you orchestrate it, mm-hmm. is that you are trying to give the best face that you can to your case. And so thinking about those sorts of strategies, sometimes in the testimony, it will say things like, it will ask the witness at the end, more or less, who arranged for you to come and give this testimony?
And so interesting.
Say, I came to give this testimony at the request of, and sometimes you can thereby see that the woman's brother is organizing her case for her.
Okay.
You know, or it's that she's the one who went around and asked people to do the testimony. And so you get a sense of who are the community of people around her who are helping her. Women are assumed and probably rightly don't have the access to expertise as much as men do. Women don't spend nearly as much time doing legal things as men on a general basis. But that doesn't mean that they are completely disadvantaged. Because one of the aspects of patriarchy is that men are supposed to take care of the women folk.
Paternalism,
So the paternalism aspect of patriarchy means that men are coming forward and helping a woman when she is in need, such as she needs to deal with a court case.
That's great. That gives my students some paths to think about. I think these types of sources are just so endlessly fascinating, but we're both legal historians. So of course we're going to believe that. Thank you so much, Shannon, for taking the time to speak with me today about this wonderful resource that you have, but also the various ways that we as scholars can approach it.
Thanks a lot for asking me, Dana. It's been great to talk to you about it.